Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Tanisha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Living with Metastatic Prostate Cancer, What's New in Men's Health? And this is part one, and today's program is focused on metastatic prostate cancer and other health challenges. And we're really delighted to be able to offer this program to you. And this is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the program today over 370 participants, and you come from all over the United States, from all different regions of the United States and counties, and just all over the place from the United States. And we also have international participants from Syria and the United Kingdom. So it's a bit of a global call as well. Now, I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers and what they'll be presenting on. There also is information about all of our collaborating organizations, and there also is an evaluation form. I will ask you each to take a moment and complete that evaluation form at the end of today's program. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the programs that you would really like us to offer? To some extent, today's program was one that many of you have asked us to offer, and we really very much depend upon your feedback so that we create programs that are most relevant to meet your needs. We want to be sure that what we're offering is relevant to help you. Now, today's program is supported by an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc., administered by Janssen Services, LLC, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program today. We have wonderful speakers today on the program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Susan Slovin, and Dr. Slovin is Associate Attending Physician, Genitourinary Oncology Service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Diseases, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She's Associate Professor of Medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill College of Cornell University, and she's been a past recipient of the Cancer Care Physician of the Year Award. And Dr. Slovin is going to address an overview of metastatic prostate cancer, current standard of care and new treatment approaches, and clinical trial participation. It's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Slovin, who actually has been a frequent participant on these programs. Dr. Slovin?
Thank you, Carolyn, and good afternoon, everyone. We truly have, I think, a very unique experience this afternoon. You're going to hear a variety of experts who I think will impart information that will be very helpful to you. And I'm going to hit a variety of different high points. I will say right now it's really been a banner year for prostate, and I'm just so pleased and more than enthusiastic in sharing some of the new drugs that are really impacting on patient survival and improvement in quality of life. I think the most important thing right now is understanding what we're talking about when we say that a patient has metastatic prostate cancer. This means that the cancer has gone beyond the confines of the prostate itself and may go to other areas such as the lymph nodes and bone, which are the most common sites, and on very rare occasions can go to soft tissues such as liver and lung. But the reality is they're rare, and of course all of these sites are treatable with a variety of different medications. The standard of care that we use for treating metastatic disease that we can see on a scan is a combination of an anti-androgen, which is a oral medication that actually blocks the testosterone that men already have in their bloodstream, and an injection, and it goes by a variety of different names, but the reality is that this injection just aborts the signal between the brain and the gonads and literally stops the production of testosterone by the testes. So we're really just obstructing the signal that is between the brain and the testes. Whether or not you use the antiandrogen along with this hormonal injection or use the hormonal injection alone makes no difference. In fact, they both work very effectively. And I would say that metastatic disease can be immediately put into remission in about 95% of the times that we use it. Where we have problems, and this is where new drug development is important, as well as the pivotal trials being absolutely mandatory, is that once the cancer gets used to the hormones, which can be anywhere from 18 to 24 months. For some people, it may be less. For others, it can be much, much longer. We need to decide what happens. We do know or have learned at the heart of the cancer cell is a site called the androgen receptor. It's a molecule on the tumor cell where testosterone would normally bind. And after a while, it just starts to get very intelligent. And the cancer cell decides that it has found other, if not collateral, pathways to escape the regimen that a patient is taking, which is essentially the injection. When that happens, any number of things can occur. A doctor may make a decision to immediately go on to standard chemotherapy, or if the patient is doing well and we're not seeing rapid rises in PSA or the patient has no symptoms at that time, we can use another anti-androgen. And it's interesting because we used to say that it was hormone refractory disease. It's not. We have disease that's where the cancer comes back despite the use of hormonal therapy, but the PSA and the disease itself can be modulated, if not controlled, by a variety of different antiandrogens. And so the standards that we have used before are bicalutamide, nilutamide, ulexin, which is called flutamide. We've used ketoconazole, and more recently, on investigational level, a drug called MDV-3100. Which will be making its way to the FDA at some point. Now, this is really very good in the armamentarium because we are able to control the disease a lot longer, and for some people it means maintaining quality of life. However, for those patients for whom multiple manipulations of these medications are not successful, the standard of care still remains docetaxel, and Dr. Saylor will go into a little bit more detail about the combinations of docetaxel with other drugs as well. However, what has been very exciting right now is the fact that while many people receive docetaxel, they go to work, they feel good, they have very minimal side effects in most cases, nevertheless, we have not up until recently had anything that was FDA approved that would allow us to continue to try to treat the cancer. We would give drugs that we know based on clinical trial reports are very helpful, but nothing that the FDA had approved with any degree of alacrity. So right now in the post-docetaxel or taxotere setting, we really have a compendium of drugs. It's really quite extraordinary. The first, which was approved several months ago, was a drug called cabazitaxel. The other name for it is Gevtana. It, too, is in the same family as docetaxel, but was shown that for those patients who had failed docetaxel, that there was a 4-month survival benefit, very similar to what Doci itself did, but this is in the second-line setting. So if you failed going through docetaxel, then cabazitaxel has become a new winner. Also, again, as I've mentioned before, the androgen receptor has become really the major target of drug development. Again, it's the site where the cell really starts to divide. A new drug called abiraterone, or Zytiga, Z-Y-T-I-G-A, was just approved. And what this drug does is that it works in a very different pathway in the cancer cell. It works through inhibition or blocking the pathway in a gland of the body called the adrenal gland. The adrenal gland is a little P-shaped organ, one on top of each kidney, and allows you to maintain contact and functionality with your environment. It regulates body temperature, sugar, the steroids you need for energy, and more importantly, it aids in the production of estrogen and testosterone. And so the abiraterone or Zytiga works at the chemical pathway leading to the final production of the active end product, dihydrotestosterone. And what's very unusual is that this blocks the pathway, and we are seeing patients who have failed prior treatment with other hormones and even with chemotherapy respond. It's an oral pill, and again, you need to be evaluated by your physician prior to just taking it. It's coming out in specialty pharmacies just right now, but remember, it's just not for every patient. In addition to Gevtana and Zytiga, another drug has made it to the FDA approval status, and that's Cipolucel-T or Provenge by the Dendron Corporation. This is a cellular product vaccine, meaning that patients' own white blood cells are removed through a blood machine known as a leukapheresis machine. All your blood elements, including the red blood cells and the serum and the plasma, are returned, but the white blood cells are removed. There's no risk to the patient whatsoever. It is then transported to a central facility where these cells are incubated with a special fusion protein that allows them to be educated, if you will, to the various kinds of markers that are produced on prostate cells. Then the cells are reintroduced intravenously or by vein back to the patient, and this has been associated with a 4-month survival benefit. And when I say 4 months, it doesn't mean you're going to live for exactly 4 months. It's a median, which means there are patients who will do much, much better for very long and those that may not do as well. But it's part of the armamentarium. What is very exciting has now to do with targeting the bone. And, again, we are able to have drugs go to the FDA because of the generosity of our patients who participate in clinical trials. Zytiga, Provent, none of this would have ever made it to the FDA if our patients hadn't gone on a clinical trial. So a clinical trial, or an investigational protocol, as people like to call it, is nothing more than taking new drugs or drugs that have been around for a while and either putting them in novel combinations with other biologic agents or using them on different schedules in order to answer a scientific question. 95% of the time, the questions are based on preclinical data, meaning in the laboratory, and are able to be translated into the patient for evaluation. With SAFE, we go through a process called informed consent, where we discuss everything with the patient beforehand, including the potentials for any possible side effects or the side effects that we know already exist. And again, I have to send out a little salute to the wives and partners of many of my patients, because without their, how can I phrase it, generosity of time and also nudging, for lack of a better word, many patients would not go on clinical trials. So I salute the partners and wives of and family members who have engendered how their loved ones would go forward, and it's been very successful. Let me tell you very, very briefly in the next 2 or 3 minutes about several new bone targeting agents. I believe everybody knows as part of bone health, we recommend the use of calcium and vitamin D, as well as one of two new drugs. One is a bisphosphonate known as Zometa or zoledronic acid that's been available for quite a while. It's been shown to delay the time to skeletal events, meaning the loss of bone mass, what we call a compression fracture or loss of height that can be due to cancer and or osteoporosis. And another drug that was FDA approved, and by the way, zoledronic acid is given intravenously, but another drug called Xgeva that has been also FDA approved for osteoporosis, but also in prostate cancer. This too is a drug that is bone protecting, but comes from a completely different chemical pathway than zoledronic acid. In fact, it actually blocks a particular molecule called RANK, R-A-N-K. It's a rather long name, but the point is it's a blocker of a particular pathway. And this is a drug that can be given and a little under-the-skin injection monthly. There are benefits to each one. They're very comparable. There are, however, patients who may not benefit from one because of their natural laboratory abnormalities. And, again, this is something that's decided upon by the doctor. Many of you may have recently heard about radium-223. The other name for it is alpha-radin, and this will take you back to Chemistry 101 when you were first learning about Marie Curie. Alpha-radin, or radium-223, is what we call an alpha emitter, which means it's a very, very high energy radiation that has the distinction of really just going a length of anywhere from 2 to 10 cells, meaning it does not take up a huge amount of area that can cause toxicity to normal structures. And one of the benefits of using radium-223, or alpha-radin, is that it has engendered pain control. It does not seem to have any marrow toxicity. It's probably one of the newest drugs out there that's en route to FDA approval based on a phase 3 trial that showed that patients who received this drug versus a placebo had a median overall survival of 14 months compared with 11.2 months. The median time to first skeletal event, meaning, you know, compression fracture, cord compression, loss of bone height, was about 13.6 months compared with about 8.5 months in the placebo group, which was about an improvement of 64%. So clinical trials are currently combining alpha-radin or radium-223 in combination with chemotherapy. This drug in some ways may be reminiscent of samarium-153, which is also a radiopharmaceutical that's been used for pain control. However, unlike samarium, there is a survival benefit with using this drug, and it's very, very well tolerated. So there is a lot of, I guess we can say that you can sort of break down the drugs, those that go to bone, those that go to target the androgen receptor. But let me just mention one other drug that somebody may mention at some point, and that is a drug called XL184 by the Exelixis company. The other name for it is cabozantinib. And this is a blocker of a particular pathway in cancer growth. And what has been very encouraging is the fact that many a patient who has had some pain from their cancer has improved, and we're seeing very remarkable changes in bone scan. It is still under clinical trial. It's nowhere near the FDA. It's under analysis to see if the changes that we are actually seeing on these scans are valid. And so the compendium for treatment now is so broad and it's so exciting that, you know, I've hoped that I've at least given everybody a little bit of a feel for all these new efforts, again, all based on clinical trials. So with that, I'm going to stop. I'll be happy to take questions later. Carolyn, thank you. Back to you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Slovin, for just a very informative presentation and with lots of information. Also for acknowledging the partners and spouses of all of those who participate in clinical trials and who also just in terms of the treatment protocol as well. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Philip Saylor. Dr. Saylor is instructor, Department of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Assistant Physician, Internal Medicine, Hematology Oncology, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Saylor is going to address the role of chemotherapy and radiation, additional topics that in addition to what Dr. Slovin had covered, metabolic complications of androgen deprivation therapy, tips for managing discomfort and pain, so quality of life concerns, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Saylor.
Great, thank you. And I first would like to start by thanking everyone for your interest and participation. I think it's really a great program and appropriate to have such a focus on patient education and empowerment. So I have a daunting task of covering several very broad and important topics in a short amount of time. So we'll jump right into it, but I'll also be thankful for the question and answer time that will follow, so where we'll have a little more chance to have discussion about all these points. So I'll start with the role of chemotherapy and radiation in advanced prostate cancer. So that's prostate cancer that's traveled to somewhere else in your body besides the prostate itself. And so when you think about chemotherapy, I think it's always helpful to think, or for me anyway, it's helpful to think of these other cancers. If you think of lung cancer, breast cancer, or colon cancer, some of these others have always had a variety of chemotherapy drugs that are helpful, that are sometimes used by themselves or in various combinations. And really the story of prostate cancer has always been distinct from that. For a long time, there was just one or two. There was mitoxantrone that was helpful for relieving some symptoms, but really not a home run in most patients. And then really in 2004 was the first time we had a truly quite active drug in docetaxel, also known as Taxotere. So that was the first one to really be shown to improve survival in men with prostate cancer. And so for a while, that was pretty much the end of the chemotherapy story. It was docetaxel, and everything else was non-chemotherapy options until really recently in 2010 when we precisely doubled the number of chemotherapy agents that could extend life when cabazitaxel, also known as Jevtana, was shown to be beneficial. So to me, those two drugs, docetaxel and cabazitaxel, are the ones that are really worth remembering. And as I think about it with my patients, as we discuss it together, the thing that we always have to do is have a discussion of weighing the potential benefits against the potential downsides of chemotherapy, because they're both there. So we know that both those drugs can be very effective in doing things like relieving pain. certainly, as I mentioned, allowing improving survival, and also doing things like making the PSA go down and making tumors shrink where we can see them on scans. But that also comes with the cost of the familiar side effects that always come with chemotherapy, things like hair loss and low blood counts and sometimes nausea, and these things that can be managed but really have to be discussed. So one thing that I would definitely highlight is that when you're at a crossroads with your treatment care and you're thinking about whether to move forward with one of these chemotherapy drugs, it always has to be a careful discussion, talking about what's the right timing, how are we going to work through these different side effects, and what are the other options right now that I'm choosing from. So as you heard from Dr. Slovin, there's so many different options at different times that these really demand pretty detailed discussions. So that's a very brief overview of chemotherapy. When it comes to radiation for advanced disease, I would say there's kind of two categories in my head of how it can be used. First, we have the most familiar type, which is external beam radiation, which is good for managing problem spots. So say you have one spot in the bone that's causing symptoms, causing pain, that radiation can be focused really on that one spot and can often lead to big improvements in that one spot, but generally not can't be used for a lot of different spots at the same time. So the other category is the drugs that have radioactivity as part of the drug. So Dr. Slovin mentioned that there have been a couple that have been around for years, strontium and samarium, and what they do is they localize to the bone and they deliver some radiation right there at the bone, and they preferentially go to places where there's bone metastases. But the most exciting of this class is the radium-223 or alpha radon. And that's a developing story right now. So it was in June that they had a trial that was stopped early because they already could see early on that it was benefiting men in terms of survival. So that one's not yet FDA approved, but it's one that we're all excited about. And that's one when you think about a drug that only concentrates on the bone portion of the cancer, how could that extend men's lives if it's only concentrating on the bone? And in reality, the reason that that's the case is because so often the bone portion of the metastatic prostate cancer is such a big factor and such a big factor in all aspects of these men's lives. So that's a brief overview of chemotherapy and radiation, and I'd like to switch gears to talking about the metabolic complications of our hormonal therapy or androgen deprivation therapy. And so when one of my patients and I are about to start such treatment, we always have a discussion, and I kind of break it into two categories. I say there's the things that you'll notice, and we talk about things like hot flashes and other symptoms. And then as kind of the number two category, I say things that you won't notice, but it's my job to keep track of so that we can optimize your overall health, your metabolic health. And so I'll talk about a few of the ones that fall in this second category. So first, it's changes in body composition. And this is one where I don't know about anyone, whether many people have thought too much about anabolic steroids, but when you think about athletes taking steroids, and since I live in Boston, I always use Manny Ramirez as an example, but what they're really doing is they're trying to build muscle and lose fat by dialing up the testosterone and other similar hormones. So what we're doing when we treat prostate cancer with hormonal therapy is we're dialing the testosterone in exactly the opposite direction. So it's not too much of a surprise that what it tends to make men do is gain some fat and lose some muscle. And that's an important thing to know about. In a way, it turns all of us who treat prostate cancer into motivational speakers trying to preach the benefits and just the essential importance of lifestyle changes like exercise and diet. So I know that Dr. Slotsky is going to get into a lot more detail on how to manage these changes. But first we have the body composition changes. Another important thing to keep track of is changes in the lipid profile or your cholesterol. And in particular, the triglycerides are the ones that tend to rise the most during such therapy. And so that has to be a collaborative effort between whoever's treating your prostate cancer and your other doctors, whether you have a cardiologist or certainly your primary care doctor. And then finally, the other two real broad categories of things that we think very carefully about when we're starting androgen deprivation therapy is tendency to develop diabetes and also tendency to have problems with heart disease, coronary artery disease, and a tendency to have heart attacks. And so on both of those fronts, I can summarize a lot of debate and a lot of literature to say that there's some controversy on both of those fronts. But to my eye, the literature really supports the fact that both diabetes and heart problems are slightly more likely when you're on androgen deprivation therapy. And that seems to be a real effect, but effect that's modest in magnitude. And so I won't throw a lot of numbers at you, but the risk ratios for both of those are probably somewhere around 1.1 or 1.2. So that means if you, as an example, if you have a 20% chance of developing diabetes coming into all this without androgen deprivation therapy, then maybe your chances are something like 23% on androgen deprivation therapy. So they seem to rise, those risks, but rise to a modest degree. But those are changes that we take very seriously because they're so important to overall health. And I know that, again, Dr. Slotsky is going to get into a lot more detail about what can be done to try and fight against these changes. So moving on to topic number three, tips for managing discomfort and with a particular focus on quality of life concerns. And so I think in a big picture way, we know that cancer can cause discomfort in a variety of ways. But because a large majority of men with metastatic prostate cancer have involvement of their bones with bone metastases, I'd like to focus a little bit more on that specific problem. So when you think of bone metastases, it's certainly possible for a man to have one or many metastases for a long time without necessarily having any symptoms. But the most common symptom, if a man is to have a symptom, is pain. And so when I think about managing bone pain due to prostate cancer, I think the number one most important point that I would emphasize, and I'd emphasize it several times because it's so important, number one most important point is it requires good communication between you and your healthcare providers. Because if we, your healthcare providers, don't have a good sense of what your symptoms are, what's bothering you, what's on your mind, then we're not going to be able to do a good job addressing it. So that communication is absolutely essential. And I think on this one, I can speak for your providers. They don't want you to be in pain, and they are willing to work hard to address it. And so when it comes to the practical parts of addressing pain, I would say there are a lot of different approaches, and which one is the best approach or what's the best combination of approaches really depends on the situation. So when we think of pain, certainly one of the things that comes to mind is opiate-type pain medications, things like oxycodone and morphine, and those can be very helpful in the right circumstances. But there's more than just that we can use. There's also anti-inflammatories can be very helpful, drugs like ibuprofen and other similar drugs, or even the strongest anti-inflammatories, which is steroids, things like prednisone or dexamethasone. There are also times when the best treatment for cancer-related pain is simply to switch gears and to use a different cancer-specific treatment, whether that's chemotherapy or a different hormonal therapy, a lot of different options on that front. And then finally, there are other drugs, other things that like drugs like Neurontin that can address nerve-related pain. And then there's also alternative therapies like massage and acupuncture, meditation, and other things that can go along with the rest of the medication plan. So what I would say is, coming back to communication, that's the most important issue, and that's an important issue right away, but it's also ongoing communication that's a very big deal. And so what I tell patients when I'm starting them on some treatment for pain, I generally tell them, I think this is a great educated guess for what is the best first move for what we're going to do, but I'll be surprised if we don't make fine-tuning adjustments as we go along. And in order for us to make those adjustments, well, we really need to be talking to each other. And so that kind of brings me to my final topic, which is communicating with your healthcare team. And as you can tell already, I'm a strong believer that that's such an important factor in the quality of your medical care. And so I think the one practical point that I have time to emphasize is that I think it's always worth making a plan with your healthcare providers as to how you're going to communicate with them in a variety of circumstances. It's easy to communicate, or it can be easy to communicate in clinic visits, but how are you going to communicate the rest of the time? Who's the first person for you to call? Which phone number should you use? if you're supposed to get a callback and you don't get a callback, what should you do and how long should you wait? Issues like this. And the other question to ask is, who else is on this healthcare team? For instance, I have a nurse practitioner that I work with very closely named Kara, and she's very experienced and phenomenal at managing patients. And so I always try to have her meet patients around the same time I do so that the patients know who they'll be talking to and who who's going to be working together on their behalf. So in the interest of time, I think I'll draw to a close here. I hope that this has made some sense. And I look forward to the discussion time when we can get into a little more details with the question and answer.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Saylor. Really, an excellent presentation, very informative, and lots of good information, and particularly around the communication issues, and just a lot of good information for people to have. I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. So thank you very much. Our next speaker is Dr. David Slosky. Dr. Slosky is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Division of Cardiovascular Medicine, Vanderbilt Heart and Vascular Institute, Vanderbilt University Medical Center. And Dr. Slosky is going to address the collaborative management of heart disease, diabetes, and obesity during treatment, the role of physical activity and nutrition, and African-American and Hispanic men's access to coordinated care. Dr. Slosky?
Thank you, Carolyn. What I would like to do in my brief time is really to dovetail and echo the comments that Dr. Slobin and Dr. Saylor made and just comment on some of the issues that Carolyn mentioned. First of all, I would strongly support the concepts of collaboration and communication, and we can talk about those in detail. And that really is my role and the cardiologist's role in these settings, because the patients are diagnosed with metastatic prostate cancer, and then the medical oncologists, the urologists are all working together to provide appropriate therapy. And what we like to do is create an early collaboration with the oncologists so that if the patient is either at risk for heart disease or has established heart disease, then we can understand the implications of their therapy. In particular, when Dr. Saylor was talking about the effects on body composition, lipids, diabetes, et cetera, these all have implications for the patient that has heart disease. And we know that we have effective tools, excuse me, these days to be able to control those factors, whether the patient is receiving a particular drug that may make their lipids or their cholesterol, for example, worse. We have identified methods to be able to deal with that, and what I call co-management. We co-manage these problems with the oncologist. So that becomes very important. Also, the communication lines that are established even before therapy. As Dr. Slobin was talking about, there are a multitude of new therapies that are becoming more personalized, where a doctor can identify a compound or a treatment that may be more specific than just a general chemotherapeutic agent that is originally designed to kill all cells. It wasn't selective for the cancer cells. And now that cancer therapy is becoming more selective or targeted or more personal, that allows us to anticipate some of the side effects. The oncologists now, the oncology community is so sophisticated that many of the pathways that these drugs work may be able to be analyzed. And, in fact, the pathways are also pathways that relate to cardiac function, both normal and abnormal function. Many times we can look at the compounds and anticipate that this may be something that raises concerns and even potentially give prophylactic therapy to reduce the effects on the heart. It's very important. You don't want to obviously sacrifice. You want to be able to cure or treat the cancer as best you can. You don't want to sacrifice that ability. On the other hand, you don't want to trade that for another problem that may be as significant. So I think those concepts become very important. In general, the types of patients that we deal with usually have some sort of hypertension as an underlying problem. They may have, or hypertension may be a consequence of their therapy, but we We also deal with patients who have coronary artery disease, where there's a buildup of cholesterol and plaque in the arteries and can obstruct the artery. And certainly under the stress of certain kinds of therapy, their condition may be worsened. So we certainly have techniques available to lessen the impact, whether it be medications that are used. We have more invasive techniques where if a blocked artery is causing a problem, it can potentially be opened with a stent. A stent is basically a metal device that's placed in the artery that expands against the plaque and reduces the amount of obstruction. These are things that can be put in without a specific operation, opening the chest, et cetera. So in a patient who's undergoing therapy, we try to minimize the type of interventions that we do that would cause more stress on the body or more trauma to the patient or more pain. So I think our techniques have become less invasive and allow alternatives if the heart issue should arise and require therapy. As we do with all of our patients, we try to emphasize adequate physical activity if they're not limited by other issues. Certainly heart health is a function of physical activity, as is other health related to other systems. Nutrition becomes important, and we, again, the major thing that we see in terms of nutrition is to try to maintain adequate lipids or lipids that are normal. Some of the therapies that both the other doctors have talked about can certainly raise the lipids or alter the lipid profile so it's adverse, and again, we pay attention to that both with lifestyle changes and also with medication. So, again, we try to be proactive. With respect to what we've learned in medicine over many years is the fact that everyone is different. We try to personalize our attention to people's needs. There are subsets of patient populations based on clinical trials that Dr. Slovin was referring to where patients may respond differently to different medication. If a patient has coronary heart disease or heart failure, there are, again, standard medications that we use in many populations, but there have been studies to show that alternative therapies are available, particularly in African-American patients who have heart failure. There are other combinations of drugs that may be more effective. So we try to analyze the type of data that's generated, and then these are statistical analyses, and then we try to apply it to the individual and tailor it to their needs. So we've identified certain subpopulations that may benefit from one therapy or another, depending on their particular situation. The other class of agents that Dr. Saylor referred to, for example, are anti-inflammatory agents, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents, or steroids. And certainly these drugs can not only affect the metabolism, but they can cause weight gain or fluid retention. And so that becomes very important that we manage these types of problems with the oncologist, because if a patient has cardiac dysfunction to begin with or has a history of heart failure, we certainly don't want those drugs to precipitate that or make it worse. So again, it doesn't preclude or eliminate the necessity for those drugs, but it allows us to manage it with the doctor. So my position, I'm kind of the outfielder. You know, when someone's hitting the ball, I have to catch the ball, but I also want to be able to make the right play afterwards, so that we try to establish communications with the oncologist early. They know that we're there, and our goal is not to negate or diminish their ability to treat the cancer, but to actually co-manage with them and facilitate in that management. I also have my own nurse practitioner who we work with, who's very skilled at these types of issues, and we've actually at Vanderbilt formed an actual clinic, a collaborative effort between oncology and cardiology, similar to what has been done at Sloan Kettering, although we're not primarily a cancer hospital, we're a general hospital. But we found that this type of communication with the oncologist is very productive and has led to a very strong relationship as a team. The last thing I want to mention, again, relates to what Dr. Saylor said. There's a concept in medicine that's evolving now called the medical home. Where is the patient's home with respect to their medical care? And in general, that has been with the internist or the primary care physician that's providing their care. But a concept that's evolving is if a patient has a significant medical problem, such as cancer, does that medical home change? Or if it doesn't change, how do the people involved in that care coordinate with the primary care physician? So I believe that over time you'll be seeing this type of concept evolving. So those are my comments at this time.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Slotsky, for just an excellent presentation and really for really contributing enormously to the program, because this is a bit of a pioneering workshop, and I think about it in an effort to really recognize that sometimes with cancer treatments there can be various other health problems that are going on as well, and the need to co-manage everything and really to collaborate, the collaborative practice. So I know everyone's going to be hearing more and more about this, so I want to thank you very much for that. And we do now have time for questions. I'm going to ask Trinitha to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we don't get to your question, you'll just call me at the end of the call, and we'll be happy to address your questions. So, Trinitha, could you explain to the audience how to queue up for questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or if you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. For those of you on the web, you may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So we do have a question from someone on the web right now, and it's an interesting question. It's which of the physicians on your team should be the team leader? Dr. Slovin, would you address that question?
I've been dealing with the captain of the ship discussion for so long that I actually think it starts to default to the medical oncologist. It really depends on what's ongoing. Clearly, at the very, very early stages of diagnosis, if you've undergone surgery, it's usually been the custom and practice for the urologist to follow the postoperative patient. If your primary therapy has been with a radiation oncologist, it's been the custom and practice for that person to manage you as well. Once, however, you are referred, I believe, to the medical oncologist because your cancer is returned, and even if you are subsequently referred out to other doctors to participate in your care, in this particular scenario, the medical oncologist should be the captain of the team and make the necessary referrals for example, radiation, or if you need something emergent that has to do with maintaining your blood pressure, back to your local cardiologist or primary care physician. So again, it depends on really where you are in the state of your disease that will mandate it. But if we're talking about somebody who has progressive disease and will need adjuvant treatment from other doctors, in other words, the participation of other doctors, usually the medical oncologist will remain the captain of the team, irrespective of the person to whom the referral is made.
Trinitha, our next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Emil S. Your question, please.
Hi. When I had my prostatectomy 3 years ago, I was told that my margins were clean, requiring no further treatment at the time. A, what are my chances of getting metastatic prostate cancer down the road? B, other than radiation and drugs, what other options does one have with less severe side effects? And C, do I still need my urologist as part of my team?
Well, thank you. Those are excellent. A lot of excellent questions. I'm going to ask Dr. Saylor to address your questions in a general way, and then we're going to very much recommend that you, of course, go back to your treating healthcare team who have more of the specifics of your situation. But as a general question, I think, Dr. Saylor, could you just address it in general so that the entire audience can just reflect on this, of guidelines to think about these questions? Dr. Saylor?
Sure. All three questions are good questions. So the first one is, what's your chances since you had your prostatectomy and it was successful and there's no cancer at the edges of the surgical margin, what are your chances that it will come back? And that, the most important point to make is that based on what you've told me, I can't give you a good answer. So there's a number of things that go into that equation. And a lot of it has to do with the type of cancer that they saw under the microscope. When they cut up the prostatectomy specimen and looked at it, did it look aggressive under the microscope or slow growing, and how much of it did they see? So that's probably the most important factor. But no matter whether your chances are relatively high or relatively low, in any case, it'll be important to keep track of you as the years go by, the PSA test being the best test for tracking that in this setting. You hear and read so much controversy about the PSA test as a screening test. But no matter what, you know, that's a debate for another day. But when it comes to a patient like yourself who's had your prostate removed and now you're keeping track of things and you want reassurance that there's no evidence of that cancer in your body, the PSA test is a tremendously good test for accomplishing that goal. So that's maybe a couple thoughts on that first question. Your second question is, other than radiation and hormonal type therapies, what else could you do to prevent your prostate cancer from coming back? And there's not a perfect answer to that question right now. I would say that the thing that I would emphasize to you is that as long as you have no evidence of prostate cancer in your body and that PSA stays low, I would argue that the most important thing you could do is to focus on your general health. One of the things I often mention to my patients is that the patient and I are both American men. And American men, in general, the most likely thing to take our lives is heart disease. And so I never miss an opportunity to talk about what we can do to optimize your overall health, not just with an eye on prostate cancer. So that's not a perfect answer to your question, but that's something that I'm always talking about in my clinic. And then finally, your third question is, what's the role of the urologist now that you've undergone your surgery and the surgical portion seems to be behind you? And that's one where I think whether it's a urologist or a medical oncologist, whoever it is that's tracking you and watching your PSA tests, I think that's it's important to continue to do that. And also, urologists would like to keep track of you at least at some less frequent interval in order to make sure that everything's going well in terms of continence and urination and any other problems that might be introduced by the surgery. So I think long-term follow-up is an important thing, but probably the frequency of visits can be reduced over time.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Jennifer W. Your question, please.
Yes, hello. I have some questions. My first question is, how do you define failure with Taxotere, and how is that defined? And the second question is, do you have any recommendations if your oncologist does not engage in a discussion, despite the patient's attempt to do so? Thank you.
Jennifer, those are excellent questions. Why don't we start with the second question in terms of what you do if your oncologist does not engage in discussion. I'm actually going to ask all of our speakers to address that, although Dr. Sosky is not an oncologist, but nevertheless is very concerned about the collaborative management of the disease. And so I'm going to ask Dr. Slovin, Dr. Saylor, and Dr. Sosky. So Dr. Slovin, do you want to go first on that one?
Yeah, I'm actually very sorry to hear that. I do understand, of course, about time constraints, particularly in the clinic, but the best that I can recommend to you is to there's actually two ways. One is the direct way, which is to say to the doctor, you know, doctor, I have a lot of questions. I'd like you to answer them. And if the doctor says, look, I'm too busy, then I think I would take the tact and do one of two things, either speak with the nurse practitioner or the practice nurse and ask them any question you might have with the understanding that perhaps they can relay your questions to the doctor and perhaps provide answers for you, which may be very reasonable, or ask if the doctor has a particular time, or even ask the doctor yourself whether or not there's a particular time you can speak with him one-on-one. I'm not a lover of email. I would not recommend emails because emails just don't have the kind of tone or rapport where you can really assess the other person. If you find that despite your attempts that the doctor is just unwilling, whether there's a personal discomfiture or there's some reason that the doctor is not able to meet your needs, as I have often said to a person who might find the wait time too long or whatever, then one needs to find a physician with whom you can have a better relationship. I think physicians understand sometimes that they cannot meet the needs of every single patient for whatever reasons, personality, time, etc. Doctors do not take this personally. They want you to be happy. Sometimes they'll even make a referral for you that maybe have a better chemistry with the other doctor. But I think if direct attempts do not work, it is incumbent upon you to perhaps call the doctor's office and say, look, I just can't get my needs met. Is there another physician with whom this doctor works that, or even in the practice, with whom I might have a better rapport? And try it that way. I think it's always important to be respectful between the patient and the physician. You know, everybody has their reasons. And to just go forward in the most comfortable and easy-handed manner on this. I would not make this into a major confrontation, but just say, look, I need a better way of interacting, and perhaps you can refer me to somebody who can meet those needs. I think it's perfectly reasonable to do so.
Thank you. And Dr. Saylor?
Yeah, I think I agree with everything that Dr. Slovin said. I think it's well said. I think that being respectful but very direct is important. I think you want to go the extra mile in giving your providers a chance to understand what your needs are and understand what questions need to be met. But if that extra effort doesn't work out, then not to be afraid to ask for some adjustments or ask for a referral or seek a referral to a different provider that might just be a better fit for you. So I totally agree that not every combination of personalities works well, especially when it comes to communication. So I think doctors and patients alike should understand that and not be hesitant to make changes if doing all the right things still doesn't produce a good result. And then one other minor thing, I think sometimes it's helpful if you write down your questions ahead of time. That way you can make sure that you're at least, that during the space of your clinic visit, you have a chance to at least ask them and give an opportunity for those to be discussed. Sometimes that's a helpful strategy.
Thank you. And Dr. Slosky, because of all of your work with collaboration,
everything that has been said I would agree with. The only thing I would add would be to clarify in advance of an appointment what type of time you need. For example, if a doctor thinks you're coming back for a short 15-minute visit and allocates that amount of time, then that can create a problem. But if you know that you have a number of questions, you may need a half an hour or whatever, I think if you can schedule that in advance, then the physician knows that he or she will be able to make that time commitment. So sometimes it's just an anticipation of that. If you're not successful then, and the other care provider, the people on the team are not able to help, then I think you have to find someone else to help you. But just anticipation of what your needs are in communication. I have patients that call and say, I need some more time more than just a routine visit. So we allocate that.
Carolyn, may I just add one little important point that I think is very often forgotten, is that many of us as oncologists may not be prepared for an unexpected turn of events on the part of the patient. Someone may come in ill, or a scan returned for a routine follow-up and the scan was not as informative or was bad news, essentially, and that may take time away. And I do want patients to understand that we always put them first. But to be somewhat forgiving if we get somewhat delayed, it's happened to me where scans have come back on a patient who should have been a 15-minute follow-up and it ended up being an hour, and that really took away from one of my patients inadvertently. So sometimes people come in with medical problems or things we didn't anticipate, and we need to really address it. So I hope that in going forward, one can be understanding about that as well.
And I think, Jennifer, but you're really making some really good points to everyone on the call. Sometimes the fit between a healthcare provider and a person seeking care, we've given a number of recommendations. If none of those recommendations are effective in terms of you're getting the care that you need, it is okay. And I guess I think we're all saying that many people do sometimes seek a second opinion. Sometimes they will ask the physician to make the referral, and sometimes they will contact of local comprehensive cancer center, the major centers of excellence, and call them and just see if there's someone that they can recommend for you in terms of getting a second opinion. So it's really important. I think that there are clearly reasons sometimes where the time issue is there. I think Dr. Slovin and Dr. Slosky both said sometimes you need to ask for extra time, but all those things being done, nevertheless, you do have a right when you come in to feel that you can ask questions, that there's some type of relationship between you and your physician. And the staff of Cancer Care also help, eager to help with those kinds of communication issues as well. So perhaps you and I can talk after the call as well. And the second part of your question, we didn't forget it. I'm going to ask Dr. Saylor if you could address the question about Taxotere.
Yeah, so it's a great question, and even the term failure of a is often a tough term to use, because really it's important to know that it's the drug that's failing, not the patient. When we think about failure of Taxotere, like a chemotherapy drug, that's been a moving target over the years. So even the way that clinical trials have been designed, there have been trials that especially in the past, that were designed so that once the PSA started going up, then the drug would stop and you'd move on to something different. And then with time, there's been a growing appreciation that the PSA is not the be-all, end-all, and that keeping track of how the patient is feeling is extremely important, and also how the scans, various scans look, is extremely important. So I think one of the more important things to emphasize is that PSA often doesn't tell the whole story. And so when a patient is receiving a drug like Taxotere, and the PSA is being monitored and they're being seen in clinic to see how they're feeling, I think probably the most important things are how they're feeling and what the scans are showing over time. And it's important not to get too alarmed with the very first uptick of a PSA number, because it's not always reliable.
And Dr. Slosky, we do have a question from one of our online participants about the access to coordinated care by African American and Hispanic men. I know you've addressed that, but if you could just say a bit more about that.
Well, I guess my point would be that we emphasize collaborative care for everyone, and if there are special needs that are dictated by someone's either cultural or socioeconomic or racial background, we certainly try to take information or data that we could apply to that particular individual to help them in their particular situation. But I think the concept of collaboration really is not, you know, it really is a general term that applies. But again, we try to apply specific information if it's available that might provide an advantage for a particular subgroup, no matter what the reason that person is part of that subgroup. I guess I would answer it that way.
Well, I want to thank all of our participants today. You've been just an extraordinary team here. I have to say this is a great team. I want to thank each of you, Dr. Slovin, Dr. Saylor, Dr. Slosky, just outstanding. I also want to thank all of you who both asked a question by voice or who have sent a question online to enhance our program today. I know you asked the questions really to get help for yourself, but in asking the question, you actually end up enhancing the call, because it gives us a chance to elaborate on points that we might not have without your question. I want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour program, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of one-hour program. And so I wanted to kind of go over with you the services that you can access from Cancer Care. Now, Cancer Care has a staff of 40 master's-level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a host of free services for you. And I'm going to start with saying that we help with financial and practical concerns. We actually help with some of the financial costs of cancer, as well as just practical issues. We also, our social workers are available to talk to about your concerns and issues, and we also offer both telephone and online support groups, which can be very helpful to people. When I think of just the broad areas that you all live in different parts of the country, the technology can be very helpful. A telephone, group or an online group can be very helpful in connecting you with other people who are coping with similar problems. All of those groups are professionally facilitated. We also do lots of these types of workshops, and so and there is a part two to this workshop, actually, on December 6th, dealing with the side effects of metastatic prostate cancer treatment. So there's that program coming up. And we do lots of other programs, and I think you all have information about those as well. And we also produce fact sheets and publications that might be of use to you as well. So most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I would not want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with metastatic prostate cancer or cancer in general. I want you to now know that you're part of a community of support, and we are here to help you. And we're here to provide a lot of different services to you, and you really are simply a phone call away from calling us, or you can visit, you can actually contact us via the web as well. I want to thank you all for your participation today. I look forward to your all being on the December 6th program, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.